Good evening, everybody. It's Wednesday night. We're getting to the end, but we still are on the joy of sacrifice. We've sacrificed just about everything, but we're not quite done yet. So you have a ways to go. Just when you thought it was going to get easier, forget it. Tonight, you're going to be sacrificing one of the favorite pastimes that upon which you spend much of your time, and that is self-pity. It seems to be close to what is the infinite. It just always has a different slant, and the beauty and the glorious feeling of being in self-pity. My goodness, nothing quite like it. Isn't it just warm and cuddly?
Sure.
See?
I don't think we should sacrifice our self-pity.
Nobody here is willing to, well, I don't know if they're willing, but they're suggesting that they don't want to sacrifice self-pity. However, that's what the chapter's about. You don't.
Oh.
Therefore, you must.
Well.
So do we know the name of the fellow? Self-pity.
This teacher here is, I wonder, is our Jamal and Moksha on there tonight? They might know who this teacher is. Looks like a Sufi teacher.
Is Queequeg on? No? Okay. Oh, good. People are leaving as soon as they heard the topic, self-pity. Okay, so let's just read through the first paragraph to get ourselves started, and then let's see what kind of trouble we can get into. Here's what I'd really like people to do. And Simon and Molly, let me know if it's done, and I'm actually going to call on everybody here in the room as well, which is not too many people. Actually write down an act of benevolence that you have been, that you have actually performed. Write an act of benevolence.
That's no excuse.
We
won't accept no for an answer.
It's an easy thing to say, oh, I can't. Gosh, I've never had the opportunity to. I never knew what it meant. I don't know what benevolence is. Sounds like self-pity to me. So it's an interesting chapter. So it's Sacrifice 16, and it's called The Sacrifice of Self-Pity, subtitled Life of Benevolence. And you read this very three-paragraph. We read this short sacrifice. What we see, there's not one word about self-pity in the text at all. I'm going to read the first paragraph, and let's chew on it a little bit together. Until one is actually able to help others, one cannot hope to attain real benevolence. Compassion alone is not sufficient. One must also have ability so that compassion is transformed into mercy. That's a mouthful. It's a lot to chew on. Let's take it a little bit at a time, okay, Ivan? Until one is actually able to help others. So EJ uses the term here, actually able to help others. Let's just briefly talk, what does it mean to help others here, Ivan?
Right here, it seems to be unspecified here, but it's related to ability. I mean, just the idea of competence or ability to do so.
So we have the concept of competence, ableness is introduced. Are we able to do something called help others? Okay. Now I'm gonna rewind to a couple of weeks ago, and we talked about. If you recall, we talked about Exodus 3:5, and in Exodus 3:5, and you'll see it again in Joshua 5:15, put off thy shoes from thy feet, for the place whereon thou standest is holy ground. That's where we have to start, okay? What are the shoes? The shoes are the linear mind. This is not for the linear mind. This conversation is for the mind called holy ground. We have gotten there and we can get there. The effort that you can make right now is to put off those shoes of regular life. Take them off and set them aside. Because to enter into this space is called the space is holy ground. It's the space where the essential self needs to exercise. And we put aside those things called the shoes of everyday life. That's the linear mind. It's the mind of the mechanical machine self. And it has our whole life laid out for us. Okay? It forgets a few things, but it's got the whole life laid out. So set that aside. Step into just exercise the sense of wonder. And wonder upon what's called the word to help others. Okay? Spinoza says that in friendship, most friendship between men are a form of bargaining. Where, and he goes on to explain it and discuss it, and basically what he's saying is it's a form of bargaining. The bargaining where we enable each other's egos. I won't scratch your ego if you don't scratch my ego, and I'll tell you which ones I don't want you to scratch, and you'll tell me the same, right? That's not help. That's something different than help. T.S. Eliot in Hollow Men.
Yeah, what's the quote?
We are the hollow men, the empty men, leaning together. Ugh. What a frightening sight that is. That's friendship using the mind of the regular world. We're looking at a vibrancy of friendship, a resiliency in life here, and we can find that, but we have to put in the effort to stand in the unknown for just a moment. And that unknown is called, in Exodus, called holy ground. Okay? That's something we can do. We can do that for this moment. So let's do that and then ask ourselves, what does it mean to be of help to another? Anybody? Simon? Anything online there?
Do you want us to write something down?
Well, I'd like people online to write something down into the log.
Yes,
because
I'm here.
I'm able to preserve the log now. You can go on the website of wingsofchaos.com. You can get the recording from this class and the log from this class, which Simon is helping me put up. So what does it mean? What could it mean? Let's just speculate. What does it mean to help another? And that'll be the beginning of opening the door called benevolence.
I myself, when I think about that, is whatever the other person needs of me. In general, it could be on the street. It could be maybe an advice. It could be my time. Anything, I make myself available for the person in whatever need that person has. If it is within my ability to do that.
Okay. So whatever it is they need, you're defining as helping others. All right. That's one definition. I think Mark Roach is online. He actually might have a slant on this.
I may read what Mark said.
Please.
Mark Roach, I don't know if this is applicable. Vivekananda said, to kill oneself is easy, just takes a pin. To kill another requires a sword. And similarly, to get enlightened, he said, is relatively easy. To help others to get enlightened takes a lot of skills and dots, you know, suspect.
Yeah.
Skill and?
Dot, dot, dot. Ellipsis.
Oh, that's what he said, yeah.
Well, that was our conversation last sacrifice, right? Where we was it last week or the week before, where we approached the impossibility of helping, how difficult and almost how we're in the despair of the job before us. But nevertheless, we come back.
I feel like I can understand this from the contrast with compassion, because I feel like, yeah, sure, I walk around all the time, let's say, going down from the mountain, when, you know, when I'm not with a circle of friends like this discussion tonight, like when I leave the community, leave the institute, or leave this special zone, you know, where it's easier to invoke the sacred. Okay, interacting with strangers. I may feel compassion all the time. I may see someone on the street. I see someone at the community college. I see someone in the store, in the checkout line or whatever. You know, I look at that person and say, you know, say, this person, this is clearly sleep. Like, I may feel compassion for how that person is, you know, if this person could be living differently, or they could be more aware, or more in the present, and so on and so forth. But what can I do about that? That's another question.
Okay.
And then, so I see this benevolence. Is that the contrast?
Yes. The compassion and benevolence.
No, mercy is transforming into mercy. So, you know, an example for me is I would say, you know, I get a very strong feeling. For instance, I work a day or two a month in a bookstore, because I'm part of a secondhand
co-op.
Yeah. And when I feel like it's really worthwhile for me to be there for a day or two a month, it's when I fall into a conversation with someone and we bring up the E.J. Gold books, or more likely it's something like Robert DeRopp or the Uspensky In Search of the Miraculous or something. Like, you know, there was a young man within the past few months, I had a long conversation with him about about work ideas, or at least about Robert DeRopp, and I urged on him, I actually sold him a copy of Warrior's Way. I told him this is a great autobiography and he should read this. I told him a few anecdotes from it and so on, and it was because of what kind of literature he was looking, you know, he was looking for, spiritual or metaphysical literature and so on.
This is a good example.
So what I felt, you know, the fact is, this individual came back in the store and he told me, this was months later, and he said, that book was fantastic, I love this book that you told me to read and so on. And that, so I felt like, okay, that worked, you know, there was something happening there.
Okay, so...
Anyway.
Now, if we encounter people in sleep, and in, as I put it, devoted to their sleep, there's little we can do at that moment. There's little we can do. But a few weeks ago, when we were talking on the chapter about super efforts, the dose, Jamal posted a really nice post on the website, and I answered back saying, you know how to make a super effort in the area of the concert music, but it's be prepared. Be prepared because there might be a moment when a super effort is needed. So part of it is us recognizing when to make that effort. So in Ivan's case, he's sitting there in a sense waiting. People come and they order, let's say they say, what's the latest popular novel? And he'll sell it to
exactly,
them.
Exactly, yeah.
Or they'll come and they'll say, oh gosh, I'd like to get a copy of The Hobbit. They get a copy of The Hobbit. And one in a thousand will come in and they'll say, gosh, you ever heard of anything about E.J. Gold or Uspensky or Fourth Way or Warrior's Way? Suddenly, that person is slightly open. There's a slight something. Now, what I say is at that moment, we can acknowledge their openness. Openness to the essential world and the holy ground that we're talking about. There's another person out there, and that's you. We're the host. And we can acknowledge it. We acknowledge it electrically. We allow ourselves to, in a sense, have an electrical handshake with that person so that the individual knows this isn't just weird stuff. It isn't an aberration. There are people working and walking that path. As Mark said, salvation, it takes a sword.
Mm-hmm.
To cut away the dross. It's not our job to cut away the dross of somebody who's not invited us in. Okay? That's not our job.
Yeah, I'd like to say, David, that there's an element there. This idea that you've brought up several times about the, what did you call it, a barter or a contract, you know, the idea of relationships. I mean, it seems to me that that's one of the ways that I would identify that I was able to help somebody is to say, in a sense, that that person is a stranger to me. In other words, it's not, there is no contract, there's no agreement between me and that person. It's a, you know, this is why I associate this with EJ telling us all, you know, for years and years, telling us to get out in the public, you know, to get out, have a booth, have a sales table, and have a marketing presence, be in the marketplace or something. And the point is to meet strangers, to meet people who are not of your type.
So don't answer.
Not to be your friends.
Don't go further on
this.
So why is that an important technology? Don't answer.
Right, okay.
Why is that important? Has anybody out there, and Simon, if you're there, you can answer too, but has anybody there actually worked at a booth, a sales booth, or at a craft fair, or some event like this that Ivan is talking about? Why is what he's saying right now so critical to what we're talking about? Is anybody answering? Yes, 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 yes. Those people have worked those types of booths in the public. Yeah, Molly, you're a superb salesperson in that realm. And there's a reason why Molly is superb. Ivan is superb. I've never worked with MA in that realm. I would imagine that you're very good in the booth. I'm very good in the booth because I wait on the moment. I wait on the moment. And I've told this story about selling the jewelry in Las Vegas a number of times.
Right.
And where I'm selling it, with Mark Einert met me down there. And this lady comes up, and there's a Minoan lapis with beautiful piece, lapis silver, with a nice drop on it. She saw it, and as soon as she saw it, she lit up. What does that mean, she lit up? Okay? That's what we're talking about here.
You have to have sensing for that.
You have to have the seller, the booth fool, has to be ready. And that's what I was trying to say to Jamal. You have to be ready. When will that moment hit? It will hit. And to the extent that your work is vibrant, it'll hit. It'll come to you at different moments, okay? It'll come to you, and it's time then to act because, yes, you have the ability. Yes, you have the ability. And this is the story. I'll make it extremely brief. She put it on, and she looked like a goddess. And then she took it off, came back, took it off, came back, and started to take it off again, and I said to her, you obviously look lovely in this. It's your piece. Is it the price? Why is it you don't want to buy it? And she said, I've never bought a piece of jewelry for myself my father bought jewelry for me my whole life, not her mother, her father, and now that I'm married, my husband is the only one that buys for me. It will be too disruptive if I buy this piece. But I let her know in no uncertain terms, and I affirmed that state that she got into.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? That leaves a mark.
Good. Yeah, that's excellent. You're reminding me of, boy, you talk about ability. You know, I remember seeing a demonstration of ability in exactly this arena that you're talking about, was that this Rhinebeck
way back when.
Yeah, craft festival in New York, when EJ went, he ran this big booth with it was a outpouring of Jewels of Ancient Lands, you know, this tremendous offering there. And, you know, there was exactly this type of incident where he had a woman where he put this Egyptian necklace on her, the Nefertiti, you know, the
broad collar.
Broad collar, yeah. An Egyptian broad collar necklace.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like a, you know, this, it was clearly an act of competence. I mean, you know, it was something that was made for her. And then actually almost exactly the same thing happened, that she was there with her husband. And, you know, EJ basically urged on the husband that this was transformative, this necklace, and that he should buy it for her. And he just refused to do it. He either wouldn't believe it, or he wouldn't go for it. But the woman was clearly, it was like a ownership of a previous life, you know. It was like a, what do you call it, a touchstone for a,
so that
for
transaction,
a larger life, yeah.
So now, once again, I pose the question, have you performed an act of benevolence? Okay, so Simon, some people have written, can you please read those? Simon, are you there?
Okay, David, I got a list here because it started. We started in the beginning talking about what it really for everyone meant a little bit, this act of benevolence. And if I'm getting from back, Aurea says, I helped a friend find a way to finish a task. Then she felt abandoned and stuck on. It was simple, and I had to think outside the box, add more symbolically than actual, but it she would still be able to finish and complete it. That's what Ari says. I don't know. Did you get, or I should read it again?
No.
That's good.
Keep going.
I just posed a question to Mark Roach, and I said, is all this thing only about enlightenment? I said to Mark, about a quotation that he did. So Mark's response, not necessarily, Simon, but I assume that is where we are all sort of heading. And it seems to me any real help leads in that direction.
Okay.
Pathworld, can other help you get enlightenment? I thought only you could do that. Mike Roach responds, probably not, Pat, but I think people can be helped by others, creating conditions that make it more possible for them, which for me is what being to being essence to essence relating is all about.
Good. Well put, Mark.
Mark continues, recently I read in I Am That by Nisargadatta, that one of the best ways to help others is to simply give them lots of room to be. Mark Roach continues, I remember Claude once saying to me that in a way it all comes down to when you see the little old lady carrying some groceries bag and having trouble getting across the street, you go and help them. Midway, Molly Midway says, people appreciate help which is context and in the moment, is in context. Steve says, painting in the stream of life, one comes in contact with those who have a magnetic center.
Good.
Mark Roach, those situations require a lot of awareness and attention, and also create situations wherein you can often help covertly within the context of the business interaction.
Let's pause for a minute and go back to what Piff had to say, because that picks up on where we were last week, Ivan, about magnetic center.
Right.
And the magnetic center, this is what we're talking about here, and how we, the ableness that we have. If we tend to have a magnetic center, we will tend electrically to flow where there are others of, we could say, of like mind, but it stretches it. We flow to others of electrical likeness. We find harmony in those that are seeking. So we do have an alive magnetic center. Is it complete yet? Absolutely not. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist. And that's the challenge of this chapter about, and why self-pity is not in there. Because if you actually hold yourself in the position of being ready for helpingness and have your sensing mechanism alive, and you're willing to stand in your essential self, not in self-pity, you might be able to perform an act of true mercy. Like when that person, that young man came into the store, Ivan, that was what you did. You spent the time in your essential self working with him for however long it took.
Well, the great thing that happens is with this is you meet a stranger. This stranger basically identified himself to me. He somehow revealed that he was looking for, that he was seeking something, in his life, or, you know, that he was looking for something, not entertainment, let's say.
Okay, define the somehow.
Yeah, well,
That's what I'm going to push us here tonight.
We did touch on this last week.
Yes, you did.
I mentioned that passage that I just happened to remember because it's about this subject from Castaneda, that it's like, the, you know, when sort of out of the haze, you know, out of the fog of ordinary life, sleep, somebody approaches you, for something, and it's, or like, you know, ostensibly, they may ask you directions. I mean, for instance, it may be, you know, something very rudimentary or seemingly simple that they're asking you for, whatever. In other words, it may be like, it's like a cover story, but that, you know, there was the indication in that particular experience of Castaneda's, let's say, with Don Juan, you know, okay, this is, there are moments in which there's something more crucial happening, or it's available for something more crucial to happen. That's what I'm saying. So
it's available, nicely put. It's available for something to happen.
Yeah.
So we, in a sense, if you read the Bible a little bit, you're going to see they use the word watch. You know, watch well. Be awake.
Mm-hmm.
Or be awake. Watch. And that's because you never know when you're going to be called on to perform an act that on the surface is simple, like Ivan did with this person. Seems real simple. Oh, no big thing. Yeah, it is a big thing.
Well, actually, the part simple is maybe what it is, but again, the thing that strikes me as relevant to this sacrifice here is sort of, you know, I would say there are zones, I mean, there are limited areas in which I feel competent. You know, I am kind of, like you said, Mike, we've had practice in marketing, like publicity. There's a certain kind of sales interaction that we've practiced, that we have competence in. So it's sort of like, oh, okay, you know, I could spend these, they're literally 6-hour shifts, I mean, I could spend six-hour shifts for the rest of my life in a bookstore and say, and feel compassionate about everybody who came in and was reading mystery novels or romance novels and say, gee, I wish that person would read something more serious. Gee, I wish that person would do something. Gee, I wish
compassion.
But the thing is, to me, one of the reasons it's worthwhile to be in that position is that you watch and watch and watch. Maybe remarkable or maybe not so remarkable, but sooner or later somebody comes in and they say, they surprise me. I mean, people come in and the unexpected happens. Like
they reveal themselves.
What is it they say? Like, gee, I read The Alchemist and it seems sort of dumb. Like, you know, what about, is there, you know, have you got something that's really about spiritual teaching or you know something about awakening or Zen Buddhism or whatever, you know.
So suddenly you see that someone is slightly open, and at that moment of being slightly open, we move forward. You do have to get out of yourself, though. You have to get out of yourself and, in a sense, make yourself available. Yourself available to others. That's the sacrifice.
Well, it's sort of like the, it's like you start out with the sacrifice of comfort, right?
I get it.
But you got to be somewhere where you're not entirely comfortable.
Go ahead, Simon.
Can I say something just regarding to that happened to me 10 days ago? I was just rushing on the street. I have to rush. And I was rushing to take the subway. I was very late. Something that I was to do was going to close the shop or something. So my minutes were counted. In the moment that I am about to get into the subway, this is a very old man, very fragile, that grabs me from the arm. And I say, yes, what can I do for you? And I say, could you please walk me to the corner? There are friends of mine waiting for me. And this was like a good 70 meters from there. And I cannot tell you, the man, I didn't know. I thought, yeah, I will walk him. When I start walking, but in that moment when the man did that, my essential self clicked in because the machine went and said, sorry, man, I cannot do it this time. I got to go. I mean, I think the guy would have been able to somehow ask for somebody else help. But my essential self clicked in right there, and I could not get off and say anything, you know, like, yes, let's walk. And I could see it all with such a great perspective. So we start walking, and this man is walking so ever slow like that. So I have to be so centered. But it's so finally I did walk the man to the corner, and I said, are you fine here? Yes, I'm fine. Well, you can go. Thank you. It was a great experience for me that to really cut the switch of the machine, the wheel of the machine, and be able to tune with him in that from that perspective.
Very beautiful. So that's, you were compelled by your inner essential self to give up the necessity, oh, I got to get to this place right away. I got to go. But you noticed you could do this other thing. So what we're talking about is starting to exercise these parts of ourselves again. Where we are is where we are. We don't have to be finished with the path. Man number 7. We're where we're at, and there's stuff we can do. And that's called sacrifice of self-pity. Because we want to sit there and say, oh, gosh, I'm so meaningless, and I have no abilities, actually. There's nothing I can actually do.
Right.
And so this doesn't really mean anything about me.
What do you want to say?
Come here and speak into. MA is going to tell a story.
Oh, nice.
Just a short story about my experience. Kind of backwards. I was the one wallowing in self-pity. And wallowing, thinking about my finances. And I walked into a store, and a lady was standing there, and she confronted me, and she asked me for money. And I instantly made the decision that she needed it. So I took out the money and I gave it to her. And it got me right out of my self-pity mode because I was looking at her and seeing how much she was in need. And later on, I was thinking, actually right away, I was thinking, why did she stop me in particular? And
what's your answer?
I felt that there was a magnetic center happening
in you.
In me.
And what else?
And that she actually was my helper at that time.
And what else?
There
you go. You got it.
I was giving to her, but she was actually giving to me.
And the same thing with Simon. He was caught in his own ego of, I got to get here. I got to get so bloody important. And it's almost as if the universe came forward, stood up and said, oh? Because mm-hmm. I know you struggle with money a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And like many of us, the inner turmoil about it. And for her to be able to stop and respond like that, it is quite unusual because there's hundreds of people that need money, asking for quarter, can you give me a couple of bucks, all the time. But this time, you were compelled to stop. And I say a lot of the time, the interaction from that angel was to help you.
Definitely, definitely. And I have thought about that since
when
then.
Did this occur?
About 3 weeks ago.
So 3 weeks ago, mm-hmm. and here it comes up fresh and we remember it.
Mm-hmm.
And why?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's taking the time to exercise these things in life, but be on guard, be watchful at every moment. And if you're like Ivan or M.A. or Simon, the reactive response isn't going to be the machine and say, run away, go away. It's, I'm going to react, and the essential self comes up.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of work has happened, a lot of inner work. Not all the time. It's not going to happen every single time. But in that case, this person, who even knows if it was a true person,
maybe
to an entity,
yes.
An angelic entity.
Angelic entity in human form at that moment to be in my space and help me.
And help you because at that moment you needed to be in a space other than
mm-hmm.
the self-pity of woe is me about money.
And I felt so good afterwards.
You felt light.
David.
Simon, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was going to make a comment. That's a great story, M.A. And I think that these examples work the best is when you least can do it. Either when you don't have any money and somebody comes and say, hey, do you have the bug? When you don't have the time or you don't have, and somebody comes right there and say, could you have the time this for me? Because if you have the money, if you have the time, well, it's easy to do that. But the thing is, when you're put in the spot that you're being asked for your gold, and then is when you give it.
That lowest part, that lowest point.
The lowest point.
Mm-hmm.
Simon, can you look at the log and see if there's some, I have a feeling there's something to be read.
Yeah.
Are you done?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Beautiful, M.A. Perfect timing. So now we have a little bit of a context of what it might mean to perform an act of mercy and to perform an act of benevolence. There's no way you can do that. Your eyes are shut closed if you are remaining in self-pity. It's only when you're able to slightly get out of it that you're able to give a gift to another. And it is a sacrifice.
Piangio says, slowly assuming the other person's posture and movement establishes a rapport that enhances both parties' readiness for electrical bonding.
Nice.
If you can breathe in synchrony with the other person, can be very powerful.
And Pianjo, if you could put that up on the website, that's really a nice quote. I'll put it up on the log, but boy, that's a great quote.
Mike Roach also says, I think sometimes we also help best by not helping, depending on the situation.
Correct. You have to be sensitive and discerning, because if you go to help where you think the help is needed, what's the brain that's trying to do that one? That's the shoes of the world, the linear brain that comes in. Oh, they need help. I'm going to go help them. Who are you? And this concept of magnetic center that Piff brought up, these are the core concepts in this particular sacrifice then. Okay?
Path World says, one night in D2 game, guys just needed someone to talk to, so I listened and he left feeling better as he got to unload his problems.
That's the D2 is the Diablo game.
Oh, okay.
A lot of the work is people do safaris together, working in group. And this particular time, then Pathworld was saying that she was there to play the game, but this other invitation came forward, and she gave up her maniacal desire to play the game over and over and over again and served that individual.
At the same time, Aurea says, in relations, I guess, to Tori May was saying, Aurea says, I got that from talking to a girl that calls me. It wasn't a previous sacrifice she talked, and I think she posted that about a girl that called Aurea, and I'm hearing my own words, and it helped me to be lifted up. And there is a correction that says, correcting to the girl that calls me and asks her questions and wants to talk about her strange experiences.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So be ready. Be ready and be watchful. This whole thing of the mask of we have to be an enlightened man number 7 or man number 6 or 5 or even 4. It's not there. You are where you are, but you still are called upon. Called upon to be ready at the moment. Okay. Make sense, Ivan?
Yes.
At the same time, I always thought, when I thought about the self-pity, is that my life jacket in that thing is to abandon my self-concern. Usually has worked well.
But that's hard to do.
Yeah, no, definitely. But it's just making you realize, like in the case of MAE, you know, that there was, although she was having a hard time in the issue that she was having regarding money, but there was always somebody that was really worse than her, and she realized that.
Right. There's always somebody worse.
And that is the point that I try to raise, that is always, I mean, if we are too self-concerned with ourselves and our situations, it just takes, I know it takes a sacrifice and an effort, but if you think, you know, the need and the suffering that is around, really, we are not really in a bad spot.
Okay. The rest of the sacrifice, as we go on, the next 2 paragraphs, start to get into areas, I think, beyond my understanding, but we can discuss them briefly. In this stage, one learns the relationship between the movements and the aphorisms, the language of the dance, and begins to transmit and read through choreography the fragments of truth necessary to future generations. One learns to encode and decode the method through movement, architecture, painting, sculpture, music, and dance. Those fragments which may be lost otherwise during ages to come through accidental loss, warfare, or as a result of superstition and fear, that we understand. One learns the language of relativity or ratios, becoming an objective mathematician. And, you know, we have a sense of what these might be, and the objective art or objective movement. And we sense that, we understand that. It's not something that I myself know. So we sometimes are called on to hold that material, like the dance movements that we see all the time. And then in the fourth way, in the Gurdjieffian material.
This whole passage, those two paragraphs, is sounding to me like a characterization of school activity. There are things that happen through teamwork. In other words, I certainly don't have this the understanding of the codes that are being talked about here. But it seems to me that a lot of this, to carry out architecture, you know, music and dance in the sense of performances, like the Gurdjieff, the dance movements. Painting is a little more, painting is more individual, let's say, but as soon as you say choreography, it sounds to me like we're talking about the activity of a dance troupe, or, you know, of a dance practice.
Yeah.
And so it feels like to me like mobilizing large-scale projects, mobilizing a team of people, you know, a school project dealing with larger-scale artifacts, you know, which is to say, I happen to have just visited some of these cathedrals in France. You know, Nancy and I had a great opportunity last summer, last June. We went to some of the cathedral towns in France, and these are massive creations by massive. Some of them took hundreds of years to build.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there was some designing mind or designing understanding behind it.
Mm-hmm.
But it takes like decades of work by masons, you know, by painters, by plasterers, by stone cutters, by laborers. It's the effort of an entire city, actually, entire community to build this cathedral. And then there's a sacred space that, you know, then you walk into somebody, you know, you like, you walk into Notre Dame in Paris, or in Chartres, like into Chartres Cathedral.
So 500 years later, you walk in.
Yeah, you walk into that place, and this is the idea, is that there's, you know, it's like an objective. There's an objective atmosphere there. Some part of an objective atmosphere.
Of the place called Holy Ground.
Yeah.
The essential self is alive there. And in a certain way, that's all that can be alive there. The space is so powerful. It's difficult to be in the regular mental space.
So that's architecture. You know, the thing about dance.
Dance, the dance troupe.
Music, dance.
I'm going to add, you know, writing, the word too, like poetry. You know, some of the poetry is staggering, like the poetry of like William Blake. You know, Tiger, Tiger, Burning Bright, In the Forest of the Night. You know,
or with more of a certainty, you know, you have Rumi, you know, Rumi, Hafez, you have those mystic, you know, Blake was a mystic also.
Yeah, what immortal hand or eye could frame thy fearful symmetry?
So you have mystic. Yeah,
so if you actually read that mystical poetry of these people, you're put into that position. So part of what our job is to help preserve that material. Because if you can preserve that material, one person will read it in a generation or a decade or 100 years and be lifted up and ask the question, how can I go further on this path then?
Well, I think that I would like to hold this in the form of an aspiration. I mean, this on page 235, one learns to encode and decode the method. I mean, this is, that would be, I certainly aspire, let's say, to having that degree of ability or competence, but I certainly don't feel like I'm there now. I mean, anyway.
You're somewhat there now.
Yeah, we were talking about areas in which all of us have the ability, you know, through sensing, we have the ability to perform acts of mercy, let's say, in everyday life, you know, in contact with strangers, in contact with people we know, but especially in contact with strangers. But this idea here is now talking, we're now talking about transmitting across generations. You know,
that's correct.
Carrying ideas and the method outside of time, actually, and with a timeless quality or a timeless dimension.
So we keep, but if we keep some of these things alive by our efforts, I've told a story about this super simple monastic place that I went to, in the below Big Sur, this little monastery.
Mm-hmm.
And
a Zen monastery?
No. Okay. This was a Benedictine. I can't remember
one of the
orders, and it was extremely simple. There was nothing physical that rang, but the space was alive with this material that we're talking about because
mm-hmm.
of the work that the monks had done there.
Actually, that's interesting that we just...
Pardon? That's right, the Cistercian monks, that was it.
Cistercian.
It was the Cistercian monastery, literally just below Big Sur, up in the up in the hills. And that's, you know, quite an order. They're hermetics. And you can feel their work. You can feel their work. So that's something that they gave to the world for those that have eyes to see.
Yeah, you know, that's something that we just, this is here, time for a word for one of our sponsors, the at Gateway's Books. We just reprinted a book at the request of an old colleague of EJ's, who is Rashad Field, you know, an initiate of the Mevlevi Sufi tradition, and you know, somebody that EJ has known for since the 60s or 70s in Los Angeles and Vancouver. They worked together and actually collaborated when Rashad was teaching in the United States. The man who's British. But this is actually a wonderful book. I've just been started reading through it, again, taking a look at it. And, you know, I was familiar with The Last Barrier, for instance, a very wonderful autobiographical book, a memoir about his initiation with his teacher, with his Mevlevi teacher. But this Here to Heal, he has all this wonderful material in there about basically that he defines healing as that a person that he himself from childhood felt like he had a perception of what we would call electrical fields, maybe, you know, of energies and of patterns and energies and flows coming from the invisible world, and that this had oriented him towards finding a purpose in life, you know, towards the spiritual path. And to him, healing, all of healing is about, like, if you know that there's a purpose in life, for an individual who has healing abilities and who has a sense of what it means to have a spiritual purpose in life or to be on the spiritual path, that what healing is about is facilitating for other people to get blocks out of the way, to get barriers, energy blocks, and so on, to remove their sleep, basically, to be able to help them to move towards what we would call waking states, you know, to be more, and to understand the work, to understand that there is a spiritual path to be on, and there's work to do. But there's I just was reading this passage where Rashad is describing that by synchronicity, by coincidence control, he went to Japan, and he was, you know, sort of like by mistake, he went. He was looking for a hotel, and I won't give you all the details, but he was dropped off by a taxi driver or somebody at this address, and the taxi driver was very surprised that he wanted to go to that address. It seemed like a nondescript place and so on. And he knocked on the door, and he goes in, and a couple of women greet him, and he says that he wondered in the first place if it was a brothel, like if the taxi driver was upset because he had asked to be dropped at a brothel. It turned out it was the wrong address. He'd gotten the address wrong. But this, in fact, he was ushered into this very, very beautiful, peaceful garden, like extremely aesthetic, beautiful garden. Mm. It turned out to be the Zendo, or the monastery of a Zen master, a master of the tea ceremony. And he ended up, what he did was he just, they invited him to stay. He spent several weeks there, and he was exposed to this, he was taught by this Zen master who knew a minimum of English and so on. And at the end, when he was about to leave, the man sat all of his disciples down, and he performed a tea ceremony for Rashad and so on. But
beautiful.
He says, he talks about how orderly, how perfectly, it's like you were talking about simplicity or minimalness.
Yeah.
He talks about the absolute balance and order of this garden, that it was a complete aesthetic expression of what this teacher was doing with consciousness, with the tea ceremony and so on. And he actually talked about earlier in his book, he also talks about English and French gardens. He talks about how significant it is that gardens are laid out.
Like, in the way they are.
Yeah, that European gardens are and that there's a whole really very ancient lore that has to do with attunement to nature.
And
the organization and the geometric plans and so on of these gardens.
So
and
what?
Is, and to Rashad, it's all about, it has to do with an attunement to energies from the invisible realm.
Which is what he
basically.
Is, which he keyed into. So we see a couple
yes.
of ways to perform these acts of benevolence and mercy.
Yes.
One is acts that we do with others and leaving objective artifacts for others as well. So think on these things, and some of the things you've shared tonight are very strong. You want to put them on the website. It'd be very good for others to hear about. So we're just about out of time now for this particular sacrifice. We have two more to go. We'll have two more weeks. We'll do a one-week wrap-up, and then we're going to take a break and come back probably in January and start in on Life in the Labyrinth. So thanks for coming again tonight, and we'll look forward to seeing you next week.
Yeah, thanks, everybody.
Yeah.
Thanks, Marianne.
Thank you. Good evening.